Future-proof extra from News Talk.
Now, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it's been a long and arduous winter. But just take a look outside and you'll see green shoots of spring as the daffodils and tulips bring some much-needed colour to our landscape. They also bring with them the nectar, which supports countless species too, chief among them, of course, being the humble bumblebee. But is one nectar better than another? And how do bees know which plant is best? Well, Dr. Jonathan Patrick from the Department of Zoology at Oxford University joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Jonathan. What are the bees doing right now? Do bees hibernate? Are they sleeping somewhere?
Yes, so that depends on the species. For the majority of the world's bee species, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, a lot of them do hibernate over winter. And for bumblebees, that's very much the case. So although in summer, spring, you get these large colonies developing, towards the end of summer, you get the new queens coming out, mating, and then they go and hibernate over the winter and the rest of the colony dies. And so what we're seeing now is these queens that have been hibernating over winter and starting to emerge and thinking about building their nests.
And how long would a bee live then if they survive a winter?
So queen bumblebees tend to just live the 1 year. So they emerge towards the end of summer 1 year, they'll hibernate over winter, and then they'll found their own colony the following year. And then at the end of that period, once they've produced the next generation of queens, then they tend to die. But
so they never see their grandchildren?
No, they don't.
They'll see plenty of children,
plenty of worker bees that make up their colony, and their children who go on to find the next colonies, but that's about it. But it does vary from bee species to bee species. So honeybees, the queens will live multiple years.
Oh, right. So honeybees, they live for many years, but the bumblebees that we see in Irish and English gardens, just the 1 year. Do we enslave these bees to work on our crops across the world? Is it essentially crops are ready, unleash the bees, bees do their work, back in your box, bees, onto the next field? Is that how it works?
It depends on the bee species. Right. There's many crops that where we rely on the wild pollinators to pollinate the crops, and so they are visiting the crops as sort of a local bonanza in resources, and will then go on to forage on wild plant species as well. And for those,
you're talking about a sort of unmanaged areas or managed areas as well.
Managed areas as well. And that's where I think we're increasingly realizing the importance of maintaining wild plant communities, some natural ecosystem around your fields, so that you don't just have a sudden flux of resources from your crop flowering, and then that disappears and suddenly the bees are left with nothing. So that that's one side of things. And then, yes, there's a lot of managed pollinators as well. So honeybees, and a lot of this is done by amateur beekeepers who want to ensure that their bees get the very best possible life so that they produce lots of honey and are happy bees. And but there is also more sort of commercial farming operations as well, where they're dealing with large numbers of hives.
The bees love it. The bees love getting out there, collecting the nectar, even if it's, you know, a homogenous type of crop they're unleashed within. Would they travel far? I mean, I'm always amazed that we use bees in a commercial way, because I'm wondering, how do you get a bee to come back? But I suppose if their colony and their home is there, they'll always come back, won't they?
Yeah, that's exactly the case. So bumblebees and honeybees, and this is probably one of the reasons why they're so useful for crop pollination if people want to grow them commercially, is that they live in these colonies. Bumblebee colonies are quite a bit smaller than honeybee colonies. So bumblebee colonies get up to, they're typically sort of 50 up to several hundred, like 1,000 maximum, whereas honeybee colonies can get up to sort of 50, 80,000.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Would they go far? I mean, say, for example, if you had a football field and you had a colony of 50 bumblebees or bees, would that be enough? Or what sort of areas do you need to... How many bees per square foot?
Yeah, this is something that's attracting increasing amount of research attention, because obviously it's really important when we're trying to figure out what kind of resources we need to support the bee populations.
Yeah,
the answer is that they can travel quite a long way. It depends on species to species. So, but for the social bees that are foraging from a central place from their colony, bumblebees, they can forage typically in the order of a few miles away from the colony.
Right.
But it's obviously beneficial for them if they don't have to travel so far, because that's energetically expensive. Honeybees can go a long way. There's a study that came out a few years ago where they were looking at colonies in Sheffield in the UK, and these bees were flying all the way to Heather in the Peak District, sort of 10 miles distant, just because that was the current best option for them obtaining good resources.
So when you say good resources, are bees, like, do bees have bee GPs that say, you know, don't have too much of this really high sugar nectar? You know, you got to have a mixed diet, because you'd imagine that there's probably some flowers that are like crack cocaine to bees. And so if there's enough of those flowers, how do any other flowers get pollinated? How does a bee decide this is the plant I want to pollinate? Because presumably it's down to the reward, the smell and the sensations it gets from those plants, right?
Yeah, there's a whole host of factors which influence whether or not a bee will visit a particular flower. But yes, you might wonder why a flower doesn't just produce super duper nectar that's going to outcompete all the competition.
Yeah.
But a problem with that is that if you just stick this plentiful nectar source there, you're going to attract a whole load of things which aren't necessarily going to be so useful from a pollinating perspective. So they'll just come and steal your nectar and won't then take any of the pollen from one flower to another. So you want to avoid that kind of interaction.
Right.
And also it's costly from the flower's perspective. I mean, the flower is using its resources. So it's very much a sort of market transaction, if you like, from the plant's perspective. It wants to, ideally what it wants is to get away with providing the minimal amount of reward possible to ensure that pollinators come and transfer pollen from it to another flower, but it doesn't want to supply any more than that. But then that's factored in by the fact that you've got many other plant species all doing the same at the same time as well. So it's a lot of competition going on.
You were looking at this nectar concentration and how it works. Can you take us through the life cycle of nectar, so to speak? Where does it begin and where does it end?
So nectar is secreted by plants from structures called nectaries, and typically it is...
Nectaries, is that what you said?
Nectaries, yes.
Oh, that's a nice word.
Yeah, fairly easy to remember once you've heard it. Nectar comes from nectaries.
Good naming work. So the nectar comes from there, it's produced in the nectaries and presents in the flower at a certain time of year, presumably.
Yes, so the plants, again, they only want to release the nectar when they're looking to be pollinated. And so the timing of this is quite specific, because otherwise, again, they're just providing a free reward at no benefit to themselves.
So the nectary is presumably very close to where the pollen is, so the pollen sticks to the bee?
Yes, and I mean, that's a whole interesting field as well, because plants come up with ways to ensure that the nectar is positioned in such a place so that when the bee is trying to gain access to it, it will unwittingly then come into contact with where the pollen is. So the plant is ensuring that pollen will be picked up by the bee and then transferred to another flower. Yeah, so bees will drink the nectar, and they store it in what is appropriately named a honey stomach, which is it's in the abdomen, the tail end of the bee. And for a social bee species, they will store it in there and then carry it back to the nest. And they can carry really quite large nectar loads. So typically it's around sort of 70% of their body weight.
Wow.
But yeah, and it can go all the way up to a few cases that we observe in the lab, like at slightly over their body weight in nectar that they can carry.
Holy smokes. So they bring it back to the lab and then digest it over time, or do they feed it to larvae, or what happens next?
Yeah, so in social bee colonies like bumblebees, there's division of work in the nest. So you've got some bees that are going out and foraging and some that are doing nest duties. And so the workers that have gone out to collect this nectar are bringing it back to their nest mates in the colony, divvying it out, and then they're also feeding it to larvae, and other bees will then be taking that as well. And the way that this goes about in bumblebee colonies is that they have what are appropriately named honeypots in the nest. So they're made out of wax, and they literally look like honeypots. Hmm. And the bumblebee will come back into the nest, stick its head in a honeypot, and regurgitate up the nectar. And then it's stored there for use by other colony members.
How long does it take a bumblebee to vomit up its entire body weight in nectar?
Well, that is what we were interested in particular.
Of course. Why wouldn't you be?
Because, it's an essential part of the bee's lifestyle. It's how they store the nectar back at the nest. It depends on nectar concentration. So for the most dilute nectars, it literally only takes a couple of seconds. They can get rid of this really quite quickly. But as the nectar sugar concentration increases, one thing that happens to the nectar is it becomes more viscous. So if you are thinking about viscosity of solutions, a good comparison would be, say, water is something that has a low viscosity, but treacle or golden syrup has a high viscosity. And so you can imagine these bees with their small stomachs and
tiny little mouths. Force out very thick honey-like liquid. Yeah,
exactly.
So how does it take to do a really thick nectar then?
So the thickest that we measured, which was around 65% sugar by weight, was taking the bees around 22 seconds. And sometimes for the slow bees, it was upwards of half a minute.
So for your research, are you filming these bumblebees vomiting and timing how long that purge takes?
Yes, so the way that we can do it, you can't actually, because of the way that they offload, they stick their head in the honeypot and you can't actually see it coming out, but you can see their abdomen contracting.
I see.
So we were observing the abdomen contracting and timing how long that took.
And so is there a problem with that? Why do we care about how concentrated nectar is? I mean, as long as the bees get what they need and we get what we need, happy days, let's watch some Netflix.
Exactly. So, it is important because the time that it takes influences their foraging efficiency. And this is something that's been known actually from the drinking side of nectar foraging, in that the viscosity influences how long it takes them to drink the nectar. It hadn't previously been well explored in fact, I don't think anyone had looked at it before we did in bumblebees, how the regurgitation side influences their speed of foraging as well. And the speed of foraging is important because this interaction between the sugar concentration of the nectar viscosity, how long it takes them, results in this balance point at which there is an optimum nectar concentration, which you would expect bees to be foraging on. And that is the most efficient for them if they are looking to be efficient foragers. If they try foraging on a nectar with a sugar concentration that's higher than that optimum, it's not worth their while because it just takes too long to drink and too long to offload at the other end. And if they try foraging on something that's lower than that optimum, then it's not worth their while because the sugar concentration is just too low, so it's just not worth it in terms of the calories of contained in the nectar. So if we can predict the kind of flowers that bees are likely to be attracted to, then we can optimize our crops to grow those with flowers that are most likely to be visited by the bees, and that would in turn lead to enhanced pollination, which is perhaps particularly important when, as you say, bees are under pressure at the moment.
Who knew? Really, in speaking with you, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Jonathan Patrick from the Department of Zoology at Oxford.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra from News Talk.